Welcome to Subject to Power. I'm El Kamihira. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves in myths, religion, history, shape us, shape our psyches and our culture. But conversely, how we see ourselves, our attitudes and what we value and who holds power, in turn shape our stories. My guest on this episode, historian Max Dashu, has spent decades looking for women's part in our stories. She's scoured the ancient world looking at cultures all over the globe for visual evidence of women, of women's lives, and in the process has amassed a vast visual archive of female iconography and scholarship. For her most recent project, she immersed herself in Greek myth and history. And in Western culture, there's no story as powerfully influential as that of the Greeks. It's, in many ways, our cultural blueprint. In this episode, we talk about women's roles in Greek myth, their pre-Greek origin stories, and what the highly patriarchal Greek mythography says about how Greek women of the times may have lived, and how it affects all of us today. How do you pronounce your name?
Dashu.
Dashu. Where is that from?
Oh, it's garbled Russian. There's a whole women's festival story behind that. And women didn't know Russian, so they transposed the vowels. And so Dusha became Dashu.
Interesting.
It's a nickname. It's nothing. It's not a family name.
Oh, okay. There's so much to talk about, and your scholarship is so, like, overwhelming. It's almost hard to, like, select an area of focus. But I thought we'd focus on your book, Women in Greek Mythography, which is overwhelming also. itself.
It's very dense, I admit it. I'm trying to both span the popular audience with the scholarly audience.
Yeah, no, I get it, and I appreciate it also. So to begin with, I wanted to just get a little bit of your story, how you came to this arena, and a little bit about the Suppressed Histories Archive. Like, what is it, and how did it come to be?
So I became an independent scholar at the end of 1969 in order to research global women's history. And the undertaking basically was, where in the world have women been free? Because we are presented with an unrelenting wall of absolute male domination. And whether we're talking about actual violent repression of women or empires and conquests, or whether we're talking about who are the philosophers, the writers, the thinkers, and the culture creators. Women, especially in 1969, women's history was literally a joke. And so as far as the eye could see, it was wall-to-wall men with an occasional queen or concubine. So that was my starting point. And I was looking for, at that point, matriarchies had been brought up in my anthropology courses only to get the ritual debunking that there are not any societies where women governed or whatever. They insisted on framing matriarchy as the reverse of patriarchy. So it was really a setup, because there are no societies where women have dominated men the way men have dominated women. And so therefore, okay, we're done with that question. Now we can go back to just universal transhistorical male domination as our framework for humanity. And so it was a hat trick in a way. And I wanted to, one of my professors was talking about matrilineal societies, and he said, but they're all male dominated. And I just got caught on the word matrilineal, because I had already read widely by the time I got into college, and I had never really seen this term before. And so my starting point was to look for those and to look for sex egalitarian societies. Because in anthropology, when they talk about egalitarian, they mean no class system. But they never say anything about men and women. And I saw plenty of evidence of non-egalitarianism all around me growing up in the United States. So I wanted to find out more about that. And that was also something that I theorized, that it was likely that sex egalitarian societies would be more easy to find among cultures that did not have kingdoms or empires or militaries. Those are, by definition, ranked hierarchical societies. And so the probability that indigenous societies, non-state societies, would be more likely to have an egalitarian ethos, that was a hypothesis that I had. And that proved out, although there were certainly plenty of examples of indigenous patriarchies that I came across. I didn't ever say, well, I'm going to start an archive. My thought process was more, I need evidence. I need to document. Anything that I find has to be documented to the nth degree, because there is this huge resistance in academia to anything that falsifies this dogma of complete male domination. And this is what humans are. So I was looking for evidence. And so that attempt to gather documentation eventually did lead to an archive. But another fateful intervention was when I moved to Berkeley in 1972. The following year, I was put in through lesbian feminist circles in touch with a filmmaker at UCLA Film School. And she was making a feminist documentary. And this was Donna Deitch, who did make a film called Woman to Woman, but she wanted a section in it on women's history. And we went around to UCLA, USC, to all the libraries, and we took slides out of books. The things that I knew about and things I had never seen before, we were just going through the university library looking for women. And for archaeology that reflected a different orientation, really, a different paradigm. Well, her studio burned down, and I don't know that documentary was even ever completed. But I wound up with these slides. So I started doing slideshows. Initially, my project was called Matriarchives. And basically teaching in the grassroots feminist community at coffee houses and bookstores. And basically showing them, look, there are these other things that we've never seen before. Neolithic figurines from different parts of Asia and Africa and the Americas. And just coming up with images of women leading in ceremony. Priestesses from Dahomey or ancient Mesopotamia. I set on a path that I think I was already oriented toward, which was to teach with images, to have images as a form of cultural testimony that goes beyond the written record, which is totally dominated by the male elite of the ruling classes primarily and their interests. You know, the scribes weren't necessarily ruling class, but to find other lines of cultural evidence. And so what if we look at rock art? The ancient female figurines that you find over much of the globe, and all kinds of other cultural testimony from societies that had still not been driven into the industrialized late capitalist patriarchy that we know today. And so at that point, it did become an archive. It's an ongoing provisional attempt to continue gathering knowledge that I can. And you probably know this already, that you have to kind of weigh the information that comes, because what's the source? Is it missionaries? Is it colonial conquerors? Is it Spanish viceroys in Peru? There's going to be a bias there. So you have to weigh all of that. The primary source is not letters from missionaries at schools in, you know, the Dakotas. You know, you may find valuable information in those sources, but they are not the cultural authority on those societies. So that's it in a nutshell. My research has really accelerated with the advent of the internet. And especially, you know, the first few years, you couldn't really find that much online. Now you can find everything. You know, there are bloggers in Portugal that are publishing really beautiful documentation of megalithic monuments. And now the focus of what I'm doing is global. I really think to understand women, you know, we have to have the broadest possible view of history in all the kinds of societies that women have found ourselves in. And the transformations historically, because I see patriarchy as a historical process. It's not inevitable. It's layer upon layer upon layer. And you know, you go into those lowest layers, you've got the taking of female captives, female slavery, subjugation of women in very violent, direct ways. And that violence continues throughout human history, but we begin to see other cultural processes using religion or other means to internally colonize women's minds, to make them believe that God wants them, has willed them to become subordinate to men. And so then you get women policing themselves internally or policing other women, so that, you know, divide and conquer is a really basic principle of any kind of domination, certainly of patriarchy. Looking at this question of how did this all happen?
Yeah.
There are so many layers.
So many layers. And with that, I'm going to pivot to Greece and the Aegean or the Mediterranean cultures, because what you do in women of Greek mythography is decoding exactly this that you're talking about, this multiple layers of mythography that is patriarchal layers on top of layers on top of layers, and kind of finding or teasing out origins of older cultures beneath those layers. And I also wanted to just ask you, it's kind of a comment question, but obviously Greek myths and stories play a large part in our Western culture. Like,
exactly.
It's a powerful, it carries all the symbols and all the archetypes and all the stories that our culture is run by, founded on.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Foundations of Western civ, that's it right there.
So can you talk a little bit about why you pay such attention to Greek mythology in particular?
The first point is that I fought this kicking and screaming because we all had the Greeks and Romans shoved down our throats. It is the most prestigious classics, right? Even the origin of the word classics is imbued with privilege and overlordship, you know, the superior ones over the inferior ones. And I didn't really want to go into it, but I started writing a book called Witches and Pagans in 1978. And what were chapters became volumes, and it just really expanded a lot. And I realized that I had to look at Greece and Rome also because they are the foundations and they determine so much of what follows just in the immediate future, like looking at, you know, how they shaped medieval Christianity and the theological systems that were so deeply patriarchal in that. But also because in so many ways, the stories that the Greeks told, they heroized rapists. You know, there's this way in which we can see the origins of rape culture, the origins of colonial domination. The word barbarian comes from Greek description of everybody who was not a Greek speaker. So there are all these codes of domination that got worked into the mythology. But not only the gods are rapists, but the heroes are rapists. And this word hero and the hero stories are something that are very much present with us still today. I mean, we're talking James Bond, we're talking Tom Cruise, we're talking all these movies that are very violent, just as the Iliad was violent, of the male who somehow prevails against all others and wins and has all these women by his side. And in the case of the Greek stories, they're quite frank about it. Yeah, you know, he took her as the prize of his spear. And then she's serially raped in his tent for the duration of the 9-year siege of Troy. It's right out there in front. And I don't think that moderns are quite as capable of decoding the messages and the values that are imbued into these stories in the movies. And before the movies, it was the dime novels and the comic books and the novels, whether it's James Fenimore Cooper or whatever it is. I think that Western civ was magnetized to these stories of domination in a very deep way. You know, first the Greeks, then the Romans. I mean, certainly there are other patriarchal hero narratives. You have the Gilgamesh epic in Sumeria, but here we're talking about what most influenced Europe and then from Europe, all of its colonies around the world. You know, that these are still foundational stories. And not only that, but the language, the Hellenic language, is just all over science, mathematics, all the fields of knowledge, technology, the words we use, all these ologies are from Greek. And you can see very directly sometimes these transmissions. For example, the word hysteria, it comes from the Greek word for womb. And so you have Freud and others, the doctors of the 19th century, picking up on ancient Greek concepts of how women have this uncontrollable womb that makes them do crazy things. No attention is given to the patriarchal forces that are brought to bear on these women, the reasons for their distress. Hippocrates had his system of theorizing where the womb was like an animal that migrated through the body and drove women crazy. And the remedy for those doctors, if she was a maiden, to get her married as soon as possible. So really deeply patriarchal reasoning, if you can call it that. And that is something, too, that has been carried along into our present history and the way that medicine was shaped and the attitudes in psychology and psychiatry all have roots in that. And I track this. So I'm tracking in the book the origins of rape culture, the hero worship, the literal hero worship. They had shrines to these heroes who were sons of gods, usually begotten via rape on maidens, who had nothing to say in the matter and often met very terrible ends, you know, buried alive by their father or, you know, whatever, because, you know, the sexual double standard. And the begetting god didn't really care what happened to the mother of this virgin-born son. Anyway, so it's all built in very tightly into a narrative of domination. And so when you think about these stories being told and sung and acted out in dramas, and through all the arts, through pottery and weaving and architecture and sculpture, everywhere you look, you have an enactment of this culture of domination. What kind of effect does that have on a female psyche, on anyone really? Because it encodes values and behaviors and attitudes. It's a strut that upholds the practice of domination in real socioeconomic terms.
I just wanted to pause a little on the timeline. You list it very conveniently in your book where you have Mycenaean, Archaic, Classical, Hellenistic, and then up to the Roman Empire. And there's Indo-European invasions during these periods. If you can say a little bit of something about these periods just to orient.
Yeah. What archaeologists and now the genome scientists are discovering, there are waves upon waves of Indo-European invasions, which they're connecting with the R1B gene, I think it is, Y haplogroup. They're discovering a pattern of kill the men, rape the women, marry the women, right? So that you find descendants over time, so you see a displacement of indigenous males to some degree. But in the case of Greece, probably there were other Indo-European incursions before the Proto-Greeks came in, maybe around 2200 BCE. That's quite late for Indo-European invasions, which we know happened much earlier into Eastern Europe, which Greece is part of, right? That part is kind of murky for us. But what's really interesting is that I discovered that some of the genome studies are now showing that the Mycenaean Greeks, the mainland Greek-speaking people, were ethnically related to the Cretans. They were genetically related to the Cretans. This was not known before. They were assuming that there was a separate Cretan ethnicity and then there was the Mycenaeans, and that somehow, well, the Mycenaeans copied a lot of culture from the Cretans and maybe even had Cretan artists creating their culture. No, the Mycenaeans were maybe 16% different genetic profile than the Cretans, and all the rest was basically their relatives. And of that 16%, you have the lion's share of that being steppe cultures, in other words, Indo-European immigrants or conquerors, and maybe another small slice of that belonging to Caucasian hunter-gatherer lineage. So what I see happening is that Crete was protected by the sea. Crete was very successful trading island, and they were seafarers that went all around the Aegean and traded with the Egyptians, with the Anatolians, all these different cultures. And here come the landlubber, the Indo-Europeans. They were not seafarers at all. But when they intermarried and sort of formed what Gimbutas talks about as a substratum, which is the original population, and then you have a superstratum, which is the ruling class, and these are the Indo-European-speaking charioteer conquerors. So you have what she calls a hybrid culture. There's a fusion because the ethnicity is still predominantly, in terms of ancestry, those who are related to the Cretans. But now they're speaking Greek, and now they have a much more hierarchical, not only patriarchal, but an aristocratic social hierarchy with slavery. The Mycenaeans are slave raiders. What happens is because, you know, they have seafaring ancestors, suddenly you have Indo-Europeans who can raid by water and not just coming on horse over the steppe. So there's this fusion that takes place. But one of the themes of my book is really the way in which, although the Olympian theologies and mythologies are very patriarchal and predominant, there is a persistent, deep conservation among the people of these older beings, these older deities. They actually call them the Theoi Proteroi, the former gods or the earlier gods. So the Titans, or in the female form, Titanides, there are these older deities who are the primeval powers of nature. The Olympians are all these stories about competitions and fights among them. And, you know, they're like personalities, they're types. But with the Titanes, both male and female, they are sea, they are heaven, they are earth. They have to do with the forces of nature. And so these cosmogonies that I talk about, Titanides, really give us a window into earlier layers of pre-Greek religion, which survived. This is the important point. It did not, by conquest, all get wiped out. It persisted. In the art of the common people, you continue to see, for example, the Nereids, the sea goddesses, are a favorite theme that turn up in clay lamps and vase paintings and mosaics, and they spread all over the Mediterranean. And there's this persistence. And it's important for us to know that not all the pins got knocked over. A lot of it was beloved. Because it was beloved, it carried through. And this even survived the Christian domination. You know, in the fourth century, with the forcible Christianization of the Roman Empire, you find the priests scolding at people because the women were still going to the graves to chant the Moirologia, the speech of the fates, of the Moire, and pour offerings of milk and honey down into the graves for the ancestral dead. There was an ancestral reverence that continued along into Christian times. And in fact, the Moirologia continued to be chanted in some villages right up into the 20th century. So that's a stunning survival of women's ceremonial practice. And both at the passages of birth and of death, you see that persistence because it was an integral part of life, of the life cycle.
Yeah, you mentioned caves as sea caves or caves as religious spiritual sites, as kind of wombs of the earth where women's rites are performed.
Yes, and often under the name of nymphae. So here again, you know, we have all these modern preconceptions. I mean, there were certainly ancient Greek stories about the rape of the nymphs, you know, these very patriarchal dominator kinds of myths. But there was a whole other realm around the nymphae, which have to do with conception, with birth, with women going and making offerings at their coming of age. And so these caves are often, they're springs that originate out of these caves. And so there's sacred waters involved. And this is a parallel line, especially the ones that didn't necessarily have an official temple built next to it, but the women just went to this crevice in the earth as a power place. And they didn't necessarily have official sanction from anybody. This is just the ancestral practice. So though it's in those corners where we find this survival of women's ceremonial leadership. But the presence of indwelling essence and consciousness throughout all of nature, the groves, the rocks, the meadows, the trees, and there are nymphs for each of those categories. So there's a way in which the patriarchal narrative is about the carrying off of a nymph or a god who rapes a nymph, and that's all the dominator stories. But there is this other part of it, of women's reverence for the land. Mm-hmm. And perhaps seeking conception or perhaps seeking not to conceive, prophecy, all of these things that we have testimony to very indirectly through written male sources.
I'm Scandinavian. In our myths, nymphs figure quite prominently in wood nymphs and all kinds of nymphs. And there's definitely, and you write about this too, that there's definitely like sort of a fear around them that they'll take away men if men
they'll
get
take
seduced.
Men and do
they'll
away
take
with
men.
Them.
Yeah, yeah. And pull yeah, them and into their waters.
Exactly. And this was something that was said of the Greek nymphs as well. In fact, it's all over. The Rusalkas do the same thing in Russia. And really globally, I mean, there are stories of this also in South America and Asia and other places. So yeah, because the thing is, these are divine women. And so they cannot necessarily, there are stories of captivity of you know, the Selkie, the seal woman, or some kind of divine woman like that, who is maybe forcibly married for a while to a man, but eventually she recovers her animal skin and she returns back to her original world and nature. So it's interesting because there's a lot that those stories carry, because in a way it's also a story of the captivity of women.
That's right.
What happens actually in history.
What is super interesting about your book is that you look at individual goddesses or female figures, and you kind of tease out their origin stories beyond the Greek myths, where those older figures may have come from. If you can talk about Hera a little bit, who she is in Greek mythology and what she may represent.
Yeah, so Hera is one of a very important old goddess who we can track the earliest in archaeology. Most of the oldest Greek temples were to Hera. And so we have on the island of Samos, which is off the coast of what's now Turkey, we have the temple of Hera at Olympia. And because of that name, Olympia, you think the Olympian gods and Zeus is the king. But actually, the temple of Hera is built 150 years before the temple of Zeus at Olympia. And the races of maidens for Hera is the origin of the Olympics. And eventually the men start to have games there too. They had to actually negotiate because there was a certain time when these races were supposed to take place for the girls, and now the boys are coming in, and they had to negotiate because this was really an intrusion into the women's sphere. So that kind of information is not really widely discussed. We are given a timeless idea that there was always this Greek mythology of the king of the gods and his wife, who was kind of a sidekick, but actually, when you look at the Iliad, really abused and severely punished in horrible ways by Zeus, who treats her terribly and calls her a dog and insults her and humiliates her in front of all the other Olympians. So that's a bad look. But already 100 years ago, Jane Harrison was studying this mythology, and she refers to Hera as the turbulent native princess who is captured by the Indo-European chief, because Zeus very much represents the Indo-European warrior king. And Hera, however, they don't think that her name is Indo-European. She is a pre-Hellenic figure that was there in the Aegean. And she, like what happened to actual women, conquering Helladic chieftains come in and they abduct and forcibly marry the native women, especially ones perhaps of the more elite groups, so that they could then take over lordship of that land. There's a whole pattern of that historically, and not just in Greece either. But we see that reflected in the mythology and in the ceremonial domination by Zeus of Hera. But also Harrison calls her turbulent because she never really gives in. She fights him. You know, she loses a lot of the time, but she fights. And of course, there's the more contemptible side of that story because she's made into a figure who really attacks other women. She can't get at Zeus. So instead, she's continually punishing in horrific manner all the women who he has raped or had affairs with. And this is part of the Olympian myth. I don't think it has anything to do with the original Hera, because originally she's not partnered. She stands alone. So these are the oldest temples. And in addition to the ones like within the Greek world, the actually oldest surviving temples of the Greeks are at Paestum in South Italy. There was two temples of Hera that were built there. They used to think one of them was for Poseidon, but no, there was two temples for Hera and one for Athena. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. You know, so there's other patterns going on, and not only with Hera, but also with Athena. And there again, you see the patriarchalization of a goddess who's clearly very ancient, strongly associated with the city of Athens. Our oldest reference to Athena calls her Potinia Atana, which means the Lady of Athens. So this is Linear B. We're talking maybe 1300s BCE or even earlier. So Athena was already a goddess at that time. Later on, we have the story about Zeus swallowing her mother Metis, and then Athena coming out of Zeus's head. And so she becomes the daddy's girl. And she becomes the one who really pushes the warrior agenda of the colonizing, dominating Greeks, patriarchal Greeks. And that's really what we see in the Olympian hero stories, is that Athena is the patron goddess of male heroes, mm-hmm. including all the rapists. Mm-hmm. Doesn't bother her. But the older form of Athena, really interesting, because there were several temples built on the Acropolis of Athens. But the first temple was called the Hecatompedon, which means the 100-foot temple. So this was in archaic times. And it was cleared away. It was maybe too small, so they demolished it. They left some of the foundations and rubble, though. and they built what became known as the Old Shrine or the Archaios Naos. So when you see the ruins of old temples of Athena, there's one famous statue where she's got the aegis, the long cloak that ends in coiling serpents, and she's holding the lead head of the serpent out with one hand. That's from that second temple. But in the first temple, at the pediment, at the very top, where they would always have a relief there near the roof, there was a statue of a Gorgon. And she was holding a serpent knot belt. She has her hands around the serpent knot. And this serpent knot is really important because later on they name it after Heracles, the male hero. But the oldest representations of it come with the Gorgons. Athena anciently is associated with the Gorgon. But later it becomes a conquest story where she has the Gorgon killed. And then as a signal of her domination, she takes the Gorgon head and puts it on her snaky aegis. But this is the later form of Athena. One story with Medusa is that she's a North African priestess of Athena. Okay, and there is this whole connection of Athena with Libya, meaning North Africa in Greek mythology. So one interpretation of the snaky hair is that she has African locks that look like snakes. When you look at the most archaic representations of Medusa, she has snakes coming out of her head and also snakes coming out of her waist, from her neck often as well as her head. There's this way in which snakes emerge from her body, from the body of a goddess. And that is true for both the Gorgons and Athena. And this is part of this deep layer of common ground that they inhabit. Athena did have an aspect as healer, Athena Paionia. She keeps her realm as the weaver. She's not really talked about as a cosmic weaver in the way that we see with a lot of other world goddesses, but she is a weaver and a teacher of weaving, and she appears in that regard. But more and more, it's the warrior side that gets foregrounded. And then that goes back into the whole script of Zeus and Hellenic empires and all of that.
Like you say, Athena is the deputized female agent of a triumphant mythic defeat of women, which I thought is interesting.
That was a good quote to pull out.
So true. So Artemis is another big figure that you interpret. She's known as goddess of untamed land, mountain, and forests. And the Iliad calls her the queen of wild beasts.
Yeah, that title, Potnia Feron, is, you know, the lady of the beasts or the mistress of the beasts. There's different ways of translating that. That's that same title, Potinia, that we saw used in Linear B for Athena. So Artemis is interesting because we see in the iconography, the archaic iconography of Artemis, with her arms outstretched and holding animals in either hand. And usually it's stags or more often even lions. And so the mistress of the beasts, she rules over that realm of the animals and of the wild world. She has to do with untamed, as you were saying. And Artemis is an unmarried goddess. Artemis is really a guardian of unmarried women. She's on their side to a much greater degree than Athena, although there again, patriarchal myth often shows Artemis punishing maidens who are either unchaste, who act on their sexuality, or who are raped. So you have this really torqued up patriarchal take where, you know, she is attacking the women who are really her natural, original community. You know, she's originally the protector, the affirmer of the free maidens who are not tied down and who love to roam in the mountains. And yet some of the myths make her into their punisher. Then there's a paradox because, okay, she's the maiden goddess, and nevertheless, she oversees birth. How does that come about? And there are all these rites of passage of maidens marrying, having to offer a lock of their hair to Artemis, kind of as a bribe. It's like, okay, you know, I'm giving you this thing, you know, don't be mad at me, I'm getting married, right? And then also mothers, new mothers, making offerings or about to give birth for the first time, making offerings to Artemis. And she's also the leader of the dance. And this is a really important ecstatic element to her, really having to do with all female communities dancing into ecstasy in nature. And then overlaid onto that are stories of abductions where men were attacking these exact ceremonies and carrying off women to be forcibly married. Sidebar. But that dance part is very interesting, which very much tracks with the Sarmatian women, the Scythian women, the Asiatic women of the steppe, and the Lydian women as well at Ephesus. And they do something like the Kazachuk, the Ukrainian dance where you're squatting and you kick out one leg and then you jump and you kick out the other leg. It's a very athletic dance. You got to have a really strong core to do this dance. But the Lydian maidens are describing it as doing this dance for Artemis. It's that ecstatic strength of women in their young prime that is very much part of who Artemis is. You know, she is having no part of marriage. And of course, the program for women in Greek society is that they're going to get married very young, and they're not going to have any say over who it happens to or anything, really. So she presents a big challenge to that.
And then you have Demeter and Persephone. It's hinted that she's goddess of grain and agriculture, but maybe more than that, like a Mother Earth figure. Can you talk a little bit about what happens to her and her daughter and the symbology of that?
Well, you know, originally we have a veneration of the earth goddess in her form as she who gives grain. So that's Demeter. And there's all kinds of brawls going on among the philologists about whether Gameter, Mother Earth, is the source of the word Demeter, as it's, you know, there's all these arguments about the etymology of the name. But it's clearly an Indo-European name, and she's very much connected with the sacred Rarian field near Eleusis and women's ceremonies of the Thesmophoria. But attached to those Eleusinian mysteries is this story of a passage of death. And I think that we could probably see several layers potentially to this story, including the oldest that doesn't necessarily involve rape. The whole story about how Zeus, unbeknownst to Demeter and her daughter, says to his brothers Hades, okay, you can have her, you know, go and take her. And there's no wedding. There's no marriage procession. He terrifyingly bursts out of the earth in his chariot, grabs her as she's gathering flowers, and plunges back underground. And that's it. She's in the realm of the dead, you know, to be raped by the king of the dead. There's that whole story. But it could have been also because there are these themes of the anodos of Persephone, where she rises from underground. So the cyclic going underground and then coming back over ground, there's like a seasonal agricultural cycle that's wound up together with that. And, you know, in the Thesmophoria, they have pits where sacrifices of pigs that represent both the earth and the womb are carried out by the women. The pigs are placed amongst the seed grain to fertilize it. There are all these cycles that are very agricultural, but at some point you have the attachment of this rape myth to it. And it's very much embedded in the Eleusinian mysteries. In the hymn to Demeter, she establishes those mysteries after she demands the return of her daughter. She goes searching with her torches all throughout the world, trying to find her daughter, whose scream she heard. She didn't know what happened, and Hecate helps her. And eventually Demeter holds all the Olympians hostage and says, nothing is going to flower or grow. There'll be no fruit on the earth until my daughter is restored. So she gets her back. It's a half victory. She gets her back for part of the year, and the other part of the year down there with Hades, Persephone goes. So this is one of several stories where you have a transformation of patriarchal domination takes place, and things are never quite the same after that. So we could say the same about Amaterasu in Japan. And there are also similar stories about Kali and Sekhmet, where the full force of goddess energy is quelled to some degree, has to be brought under taming. So that's one of the themes that goes on. And what's really interesting is that we have not just that archaic story of Demeter and the rape of Persephone and her recovery of her daughter, but we have also other layers that happen later in the Orphic traditions, where not only is Persephone raped, but Demeter is also raped. Zeus rapes his own sister. This is actually where Persephone comes from. He rapes Demeter, and that's where Persephone originates. And this is all part of a script, very patriarchal, mythological transformation that is intended to make Zeus, to remake the youngest of all the Olympian gods into the father of all. And he does this by swallowing the entire creation and then vomiting it back out. And this is kind of a really bastardized form of a male birth. You know, he has no womb to give life forth from, so he has to swallow the world and then spit it back up. And now that supposedly makes him, by this magical transformation, the elder of all, not only his mother, but his grandmother and all the beings that came before him. So that's the Orphics.
Just so interesting to me, because obviously male humans or gods can't give life, and this like absolute preoccupation with the patriline,
yeah,
or with being the originator of life, it runs through the whole thing. The female figures represent, like you said, the unrestrained sort of powers of nature. And you actually say here in your book that genealogies are a central preoccupation of Greek myth and legend. And so it's all about genealogies, the patriline.
And the taming of female power so that that lineage can be controlled by men who are not the point of origin. And they have to assure that they know the paternity. So there have to be all these hedges built around each female figure to ensure that this is, in fact, his lineage and not someone else's. And then the other part of it is that Zeus is always looking over his shoulder because he's afraid that he's going to be overthrown as he overthrew his father and his father overthrew his father. There's that death element built into patriarchal domination that, you know, the mythic record tells us very clearly that's what's going on. What you said before, though, about the way that the men, they basically mythically try to appropriate birth for their own ceremonies, the male birth theme that I talk about in the book, but also in a wider global context. So like even the concept in Christianity of being born again, the first birth was not good enough. It has to be a male birth. It has to be a ceremonial birth because they're so insecure because mama's baby, papa's maybe. You know, and that's an African-American proverb, you know, because the motherhood is known, it's seen, you watch her belly grow and then she has the baby and the guy is never really sure, is that mine or not? And there's been a lot of violence unleashed over the millennia on women in that male insecurity, both directly in the fear that it wasn't his child, but also in customs that are intended to control her, to ensure that such a thing would never happen. I mean, the whole chastity code. The obsession with virginity and female sexual fidelity and the sexual double standard, that's all around this very issue.
That's right, which brings us to Helen of Troy, I think, and the Iliad, and her as a figure in that sense, in that sexual freedom double standard.
Initially, first, let's just posit that there is an older layer to Helen in which she's a goddess in Sparta, born of an egg, and she has twin brothers. So the question arises, why does the kingship go with Helen? Because she has brothers. So if this is such a patrilineal system, then why aren't they the king? Her husband, Menelaus, becomes the king of Sparta. So that's one puzzle right there. And then you have the whole story, which is not told in the Iliad, but is in other poems of the epic cycle, where this actually goes back to the rape of Thetis, who is a creator goddess in the Spartan world, very important. A sea goddess who is a creatrix in the Titanides tradition, but who in the Iliad is transformed, well, in the epic cycle, I should say, is transformed into a goddess who is raped by a mortal at the command of Zeus. A prophecy has been given that a child of Thetis will be powerful enough to overthrow Zeus. So he has to ensure she will not marry a god. And so he forcibly marries her to Peleus, a man. All the gods come to the marriage of Thetis, including the goddesses, which is really bad already that they would sanction a rape marriage, but there you go. And at that marriage, Eris, the goddess of discord, was not invited, and she's angry. So she rolls the golden apple into the company, and it's inscribed for the most beautiful. And a fight breaks out between Athena, Aphrodite, and Hera about whether which one should get the apple. So this is the whole beginning of the Trojan War. This is the prehistory of the Trojan War. Aphrodite wins because she promises the most beautiful woman in the world to the judge, Paris, who is from Troy. He picks Helen. And so then Aphrodite causes Helen to fall in love with Paris, and she elopes with him and goes sailing off to Troy. All right. The suitors of Helen had all sworn to support whoever, you know, the fear was that one would kill whoever married Helen. It would be a terrible mess. And so they all swore that they would support whoever the husband was of Helen. And so when Helen goes off to Troy, the idea is that she's been abducted and they have to go take her back from the man who abducted her. She belongs to Menelaus. She has no say in it, according to them. They have to get her back. Will she? Nil she. So that's the reason for the Trojan War. In the Iliad, Helen is made into a shameful figure. She has left her true and rightful husband and gone off purely from sexual desire to be with this other man and must be forced to return. Helen gets a really bad rap in the Iliad. She's made into this dog-like woman. She's made to say about herself that she's a shameful figure and just like really, really bad. But that is the sexual double standard because, of course, Menelaus and all the male warriors who are invading Troy can rape any woman that they choose, right? It's all through force. And who I think is the really more interesting figure, I mean, Helen is interesting because she is a goddess and she is in some ways associated with this access to the kingship. Anyway, Briseis, to me, is the most interesting figure. The whole action of the Iliad actually turns on the captivity of Briseis, who is torn from her family, her brother and father slain by Achilles. She becomes his sex slave. He carries her back to the Greek camp in Troy, where he is raping her nightly in his tent. The Greek camp is full of these female captives who are being raped. All these rape stories are given a great deal of cover by modern commentators. Who, you know, it's like, and Zeus loved so-and-so, and Apollo fell in love with so-and-so, and they're really raping these women, you know, and the same here with the captives of the glorious Greek heroes. The whole Iliad is designed to praise their gory deeds. But Briseis, she's kind of a nil figure in some ways. She's just an object to be fought over between King Agamemnon, who leads the armies, and Achilles, who is the greatest warrior. Finally, Achilles goes into a pout because Agamemnon takes Briseis away from him, and now he's going to rape her. And Achilles is pouting in his tent and refuses to fight anymore. And the Greeks are starting to lose. So Agamemnon is offering all these female chattel and treasure to Achilles, and he's refusing to yield. And so this is the storyline for much of the Iliad. And then finally, he is prevailed upon to go along, and it's like, okay, I'll go back to battle. And then, of course, the Greeks win. Briseis knows very well that when Achilles dies, she's going to be handed off to another rapist. And that's what happens. And that's also what happens to all the Trojan queens. You know, Andromache, the wife of Hector, and they have a conversation in the Iliad where she's like, you know what's going to happen to us. Don't go out there and fight just to win glory. Your child is going to be thrown from the battlements and, you know, I'm going to become a sex slave. You know, he knows she will be a slave. He even says so, but he doesn't ever touch on the rape aspect of it. This is something, too, I talk a lot, not only just about the Trojan War, but the overall pattern of Mycenaean warlords that are raiding for slaves. And it's very much, it's not to say there were no male slaves, but the pattern is taking female slaves. And so you've got this rape aspect of slavery very much up in front. But also these women were being used to create wealth. They were weaving, and textiles were one of the major forms of wealth in the trading system of late Bronze Age Europe. You see in the records in Linear B that in the palaces, they have all these women and they're being given rations. They are being made to produce a set quotient of cloth that then redounds to the wealth of whichever the palace warlord is. There's a whole economic, the lower part of the iceberg, under the waterline of history, of what happened to all those hundreds of thousands of women, millions, I don't know. We have traces of that also in the Sumerian world, because the characters for slave in cuneiform are mountain woman. So the Sumerian armies would go up, they'd raid the mountain villages, they'd drag back women, and they too were being put to work weaving, making wealth.
Yeah, no, it's painting a picture what the historical, you know, roots to these stories are. It's a frightful reality for women for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Matriarchal villages and small societies all over the place getting raided and having their women taken captive.
Devastated.
Devastated.
Yeah. So that's the tough part of it. But I think it's necessary for us to look at that because those are historical patterns that we see happen all over the world in different time periods. And it's the way that patriarchy and conquest or militarism are so closely intertwined, just as class systems and patrilineal descent are very strongly correlated over much of the planet. We have a very intersectional view in order to understand all the layers to this. It's not so simple as just once women were free and then male dominators came and conquered them and then it was all patriarchy. It's far, far more complex. And there are periods and movements of women's resistance or even recuperation that happen. There's a lot of layers to it. But I think that the elements of cultural preservation, the women under very hard conditions over time managed to pass on to their daughters the spiritual traditions of their mothers. So that there, you do have this through line also, not only just the dominator one, but also of land reverence, weaving, ceremony, dance, the geometric period after about 900 BCE. You see many representations of with women's dance and very often around dance, hand in hand, sometime with branches of greenery clasped together between their two hands. There is beauty to be found as well.
Which really gives you the idea how much these cultural forces was coexisting or existing in parallel and overlapping parallels over time.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there's so much about this that is down to interpretation. And that's what I wanted to say earlier about the nymphae. Modern writers constantly trying to excuse the rapes. And using exculpatory language that kind of muffles it and clouds it up and hiding from view what the actual tradition said and excusing it or even getting off on it and saying, well, you know, this is how it was.
Yeah, and the thing about the pervasiveness of rapes of goddesses, rapes of queens, rapes of priestesses and so on, it really makes you think about the messages this would send to the women in the population.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big part of the point of it is women have to be convinced that it's all inevitable. You know, this is just how it is. And you have to accept it because there's nothing that can be done. This is just how it is. Because in the myths, there are very few common women, you know, the mythical queens like priestesses, like you were saying. But really, the bulk of these rapes are happening to female captives, enslaved women. Commoners, they don't count. There's no one to defend them. There's no, you know, even their male relatives are not powerful to do anything against the elite that run the whole entire show. I have a whole chapter on the Barbari, so women of the other nations. There's a lot of other stories about Scythian queens and Libyan queens and many times very demonized figures who are, oh, those other women over there, they don't do things. They're strange. They don't do things the way we do. They're barbaric, but they do not cede to men. And to some extent, there was some truth in it, and there was also some exaggeration in it, because at that period of time, we're dealing with patriarchal societies in greater, lesser degree. But certainly, if you're born a Scythian woman, we know that they rode to the hunt and to war. Adrienne Mayer has documented very well examples of women all over the Caucasus and the steppe who, you know, were buried with arrow wounds in their head or axe wounds and were buried with weapons themselves. And they were very clearly women warriors. This to the Greeks was a very strange thing. And they made up all kinds of weird stories about these women. Like, well, they couldn't have really done archery because their tits would get in the way. So they had to hack off one of their breasts in order to be archers. You know, this is totally ridiculous. But it's amazing how those memes made up by Greek writers spread so that this stuff becomes very contagious.
For ordinary Greek women of the time, if goddesses and priestesses could be raped, then that makes
exactly.
It completely normal or
no hope.
Know, No
you
hope.
You can't escape it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the way marriage is framed in Greek mythology. Like in some ways, it seems like a protection racket.
Or inevitable.
Or inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's an example. I finally thought of a mythic application, and that's Hera.
Oh, sure.
Hera, yeah. In some of the stories, is forced to marry Zeus because he rapes her. He tricks her. There's a number of stories where Zeus is tricking women in order to get sexual access to them. Hera, one of her animals was the cuckoo. And so she has a cuckoo on her staff. She has cuckoo on her throne. The cuckoo goes back to the Cretan iconography, too. So that's that archaic side of Hera. But he takes the form of a little wounded cuckoo, and she brings it to her breast, and then he turns back into a man now that he's up close to her and rapes her. So in the patriarchal framework, you have to marry the rapist because you are going to be disgraced. And not only you, but your family will disgrace. They will all put pressure on you that this is what you have to do. And so she does. She marries him. And not only that, she becomes the goddess of marriage. You know, she had to go along with it. And then symbolically, what does that say about Greek marriage? And then a lot of the rest of it, you know, it isn't necessarily a marriage. It's just a rape and a conception. And this is back to the genealogies. This is where this hero comes from. This is where that hero comes from. And this is how they came about. And it's to put these heroes who are warlords and dynastic founders into a genealogy of the gods. You know, so it gives them a divine lineage. And that's another global pattern, this idea that of divine rule. That, you know, the warlord who conquers is somehow divinely intended to be the head of government because, you know, he's descended from this divine lineage. And you see that in Africa and a lot of other places. Might makes right.
You do talk about women's sort of despair. There are several examples of women killing themselves out of despair or desperation or shame. Or
I talked before about the hero stories, and there are also heroine shrines and stories. And a lot of the heroines, sometimes the heroines are victims. And this is very strange. Why would you heroize someone who is being oppressed and badly treated and finally ends up committing suicide because there's nowhere else for them to go? But I've seen this pattern in other patriarchal societies. It goes back to the idea where the mythologies present us with this whole parade of depressing stories intended to demoralize women. And they are both praised for, like, you know, being subjugated, or they're, okay, well, you know, they had to commit suicide because someone raped them and their father was going to kill them, so they jumped off a cliff. There's a lot of cliff-jumping women in the Greek mythology,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
You know, that's really hard stuff. There's something else I wanted to mention, which is that I don't want to get the impression, because this is another shibboleth in classics, this idea that this great Greek miracle arose from nowhere. And there are actually very strong African and Asiatic influences on Greek civilization. The writing itself, as Herodotus tells us, came from Phoenician letters. That's actually what they called the alphabet there for a while. And so there's a lot more scholarly assent and confirmation to the idea that West Asian cultures influenced Greeks, and a pretty dug-in-the-heels resistance to the idea that Africa influenced the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Egypt influenced Crete and the Aegean Islands very intensively. They also influenced the Phoenicians, who influenced the Greeks. So a lot of things that we see that look like, okay, that was Phoenician influence, they themselves have Egyptian prototypes. You have both Phoenician and Egyptian influences going on in these islands. But one of the things that I present in the book is evidence for Libyan influence. I saw a really strong parallelism in the iconography of the geometric painting in Greece, say around 800, 700 BCE, and Libyan rock art. And I have never seen that same silhouette or representation of women's bodies anywhere else but in those two places. Well, we don't really know a whole lot about what was going on in Greece at that time. This is after the fall of the Mycenaean states. So it may be that there was some kind of cultural exchange, or I don't know, Libyan artists. I'm not sure what happened. But that's something that I thought was important to bring through, because Greek studies, more than anything else, is shown to us as being the quintessential European tradition. And the idea that there were actually all these foreign influences, especially from Africa and Asia, is not something that really gets credited very often. I mean, everything is global. All cultures experience influences from other places. But this idea of the specialness of the Greeks, again, it's not to deny the beauty of Greek architecture or art, but just more to say that there are these ways that they were interacting, you know, across the seas with these other cultures.
Right. And if we know that the steppe cultures of Europe influenced so much of Greek culture, why can't we conceptualize people coming from the south or across the sea from North Africa just as easily?
It's interesting because especially the way, and this is true for the Norse as well, we give them this monolithic idea of this is Greek mythology. And there's no idea that there are all these local traditions or all these historical variations, you know, the ways the stories change over time. And again, I think that that's sort of the nature of history itself, is the way it's so layered. In academia, they would call it textual stratification. You know, there's the earlier layers, and then later on, oh, this is when this theme appears, and this is how it transforms. You know, there's various different aspects.
The constant transformation of cultural stories, myths, and art, that whoever the dominant force in the culture is at the moment takes whatever is there
right.
and make it their own to further their own sort of cultural aims.
Yes, and this is something that's really important because of the way that Greek mythology has been such a fertile ground for Renaissance, Baroque, Romantic, and present day pornification of mythology.
Yes.
You know, the favorite stories of the rapes of these groups of women or the gods carrying off this nymph or this woman is just pervasive in European art. And they're enjoying it. And the woman is made to look so helpless and so foolish. You know, she's throwing her hands up in the air. It's like she can't even fight back. And it transmits the most retrograde messages possible because it's both presenting her nakedness to the eye as something for the male gaze, but it's also giving a message to women. It's like, there's no hope. You can do nothing. And, you know, and women are seeing the entire society treating this as normative, as indeed even just like the study of the female nude has been in art schools forever and ever. Some of that was already present in the Greek art, particularly I think about Cassandra. So here's a Trojan princess, and she takes refuge at the foot of the Palladion because the Greeks have taken Troy, and they're coming in there to rape her. And so the warrior Ajax comes in and grabs her. So the way that's represented in Greek art is that she's already naked. Sometimes she has her legs spread. I mean, this is a princess, and presenting her naked, it's already, they don't actually show rapes. The actual sexual act. They show the carrying off represents the rape, you know, so he's bearing her away on his shoulders. But in those paintings of Cassandra, it's like they're preparing the male gaze. This is what's going to happen to her. And that's why we're showing her their legs splayed open. And there's a lot of examples of that also in European art of the last 500 years.
When you start thinking about it and seeing it that way, especially going into any traditional art museum, that is what you are going to see as a woman,
yeah.
is a massive amount of naked women.
Right.
Or vulnerable women. I don't think we talk enough about this.
No. It's really the wallpaper, you know? It's just the background for everything. And it's so accepted. It's so much the context that it would be threatening for a woman to even raise the issue. I mean, it was when we started in the late 60s and 70s to start to question and challenge the cultural norms that were so embedded. There was a lot of pushback, and there still is. I think in some ways it's almost recuperated itself, you know, that it's considered to be prudish or something, you know, because it's all been framed so successfully. This is what art is. And a lot of times women just have to even have the question asked. It's like, oh, I never thought of that. Or maybe they did. And, you know, they just didn't find anywhere compatible to even be able to express their doubt or their discomfort.
Yeah, it is such a main thrust of our whole culture. And, you know, I'm also jumping straight to actual porn.
Which has gotten so extreme.
Which has gotten so extreme and extremely normalized in that, you know, this is just the water we swim in.
It totally is. Of course, there are all kinds of political actions and economic changes that need to be done, but there's a way in which representation and story or myth, if you will, have a dramatic impact on the sea that women have to swim in culturally and the choices they feel are available to them. You know, because if you challenge that background, that cultural background, that puts you on the out. I think that, you know, the gonzo porn that now predominates, it's violent and degrading and profoundly misogynist, and sex is being choked and sex is being, you know.
That's right. But I found reading your book, making constant connections back and forth with this reality and the reality of rape in Greek stories and Greek myths, just the pervasiveness of it and the brutality of it is just...
It's extensive.
It's extensive. Really, yeah.
Yeah, that's really why I'm writing this. It's like, I really didn't want to do the Greeks because I don't think anybody escapes getting taught about that. But there's a way in which it's really significant and we have to really interrogate current cultural structures in the light of that, of how they frame things and how those framings still prevail. It's like feminism is a cultural revolution and it's an ongoing process because there are backlashes and we're facing a lot of backlashes. We're not by no means through with all of this, but you know, we have to be able to deal on multiple levels. And as I was saying, political action is important, but you have to have also a cultural activism that says, wait a minute, this is not right. This is not okay. We can teach the Greeks, and this is what I'm trying to do in the book, we can teach about it, but from a very different angle of view than the constant lavishing of praise on the greatness of Greek art without ever mentioning the fact that, you know, women are being ripped away from their family or whatever is going on in those images.
Yeah, the brutality and humiliation of women, like you called it, the wallpaper. And I do think, like you said, looking at the whole world together is really important.
Yeah, and there's like a whole thing about pattern recognition. There are clearly differences culturally between different regions, continents, but I also see a lot of recurring patterns. And those are important to look at all of that.
I really appreciate you putting out as much and making available and accessible so much of your scholarship just out there for anyone on the internet.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much for talking to me. And
thank you, Ella.
I look forward to connecting again.
Same here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Subject to Power. You can find the show online at subjecttopower.com or subscribe to the show wherever you find your podcasts. I'd love to know your thoughts on these conversations, so please drop a note on the website or find us on social media. The best way to support the show is to rate and review Subject to Power on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other listeners find us. Subject to Power is written, hosted, and produced by me, El Kamihira. Audio engineering is done by Jason Sheasley at Abridged Audio. Cover art by B. Johnson. And music by Beware of Darkness.